What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday? Supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by former CIA officer and Green Beret, James Stayskull. During the 1970s and 80s, James was stationed in Berlin, and today he talks us about some of those experiences and his excellent book, Berlin, A Spy's Guide to Its Cold War History. Just a quick heads up, James is under the weather during this recording and we had a few connection issues, so unfortunately the audio quality is not the best it could be, so apologies for that. Apart from that, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you for watching, thank you for listening, take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
James, welcome to Secrets and Spies. It's wonderful to have you on.
Thank you very much.
Could you just give us a very brief overview about what your book is about?
My book, A Spy's Guide to Berlin, actually, Berlin, A Spy's Guide, it's my view of the Cold War history of the city from the end of the war until 1990. Not only what I experienced, but what the city experienced in this wonderful town that was the focal point of so much war power, conflict, and confrontation. It was a quiet war that was fought on the streets of the city, inside the bars, inside the restaurants, and on the wall. It's a memory of the important places that figured in that war, in that Cold War, and why it remains important.
Fantastic. And it is a great book with some brilliant photos. And I like the way you sort of ordered it as well. It's sort of both a kind of a how-to spy as well as the history of the actual city as well. So it's really, really well done.
Well, that's an interesting point because a lot of techniques and ideas for intelligence tradecraft in the parlance started there. And you can see that kind of vocabulary reflected probably mostly in the Carré's book. It's definitely an interesting place. Being able to go back and see approximately what the Carré depicted in The Spy Who Came In, it was an interesting place and it remains so.
Before we kind of go into talking about Berlin in detail, I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about your connection to Berlin.
Well, actually, my connection to Berlin is the only reason why I wrote the book.
Mm-hmm.
I trained in the army, I should say, as a paratrooper, and then with special forces. joined Special Forces that was serving in the United States. Although we were doing field exercises in Europe and other places, I got an offer because of my background and my language ability to serve in Berlin. Mm. That was fairly, I mean, the second third of my career, I guess. So I spent on two different occasions about years in the city as a member of a Special Forces unit. It was a classified unit at the time, and it really set my goals and my interests for the rest of my life of working in civilian clothes, working in intelligence-related and special operations type operation type missions. And I suddenly struck me several years ago that Berlin is not my favorite city to visit as a tourist, but it's a city that's got a lot of personality. And as I think I'd put it, if I can remember this correctly, it's a city that you can leave, but it never quite leaves you. And that's the kind of impression the city made on me. Mm. When I first got there, Cold War, varying crises going around the world, but it seemed like Berlin was one of the focal points for the difficulties of political and national difficulties that were going on around the world. So it's a very impressive city. And like I said, I kind of got stuck there.
Fantastic. Just before we kind of go into Berlin's history, so thank you for telling us a little bit about your connection to Berlin. And you were there late 70s to the early 80s, which was must have been a fascinating time. And were you there when the Berlin Wall came down?
Well, actually, I was there from 77 to 81, okay. And then again from 84 to 89. And I actually left just before the wall went down, and I was with another unit. When the wall came down, interestingly, I got a telephone call from a friend of mine who had served in Berlin with me. He said, turn on CNN. This is the 9th of November, 1989. I turn it on, and there it is, you know, the telecast from the Berlin Wall, all the people, the bananas, everything. the next day, I booked a flight on Pan Am, and I was in the city on the 10th, 11th of November, and went straight to the wall and spent about the next 3 weeks, I think, in Berlin with friends and everything. So it was quite a scene, quite chaotic, and just sort of a culmination of everything that we had been.
Yeah.
That's changed now. But.
And what was it like? Because you were describing in your book about how Berlin's a bit like, you know, because you're kind of on the front line of the Cold War, but then you could go off and get a schnitzel in a bar somewhere and be almost oblivious to it. What was that sort of duality like whilst you were there?
Yeah, well, you described it well. It was weird. on one hand, you could see the difference between the two cities, between West Berlin and East Berlin. On one hand, it was very threatening. And on the other hand, it was kind of exhilarating to know that you were there with a very special purpose, although it might have been suicidal, to fight the war if it would come up. But I think the Germans sometimes called it Hexenkessel, the witch's cauldron, because you were isolated, stuck inside the small city. You could not travel easily. You could fly out, you could drive out, but special procedures and everything else. And some people felt like it was too oppressive. It was like being in a zoo.
Oh, yeah.
We kind of disparagingly or jokingly probably called it the world's largest POW camp if the war had come along.
Mm.
It was it's very hard to describe, but it was just sort of a unique feeling of being in a city, having a special purpose, and then being surrounded by about a million Soviet Warsaw Pact soldiers. So it was, I just, like I said, I love being stationed there, and that's why I served there twice. So
yeah, fantastic, fantastic. So obviously, there are many cities that claim the title City of Spies, but why do you feel Berlin deserves it more than other cities like Vienna or Washington, D.C.?
Well, Vienna was, right after the war, on par with Berlin. It had the same arrangement, a four-power split between the Soviet Union and then what I now call the Allies, France, Britain, and the United States. So it was similar. And you can see that in some of the movies, like the Third Man. But then Vienna eventually got return to the Austrians, self-governance. Berlin never did. And there are other cities that had a lot of spy things going on. Bonn, obviously, London to some extent, Washington also. And then going east, places like Hong Kong. You can look at Saigon, but those were all more regionally oriented and on a much less, much smaller scale than in Berlin. Berlin was a special status city under the control of four different countries. The Germans had no real power there. So it was sort of like a place to have a free-for-all. It was like having a rugby match with four teams and no rules.
Yeah. Berlin obviously was important for espionage, and was it important because of the espionage, or was it, or did it become inevitable that it would become a hot spot of espionage because of its sort of Berlin, the sort of post-war status?
The old chicken and the egg.
Yeah, the chicken and the egg.
It was the capital of Germany prior to World War II, and it became again 1992. And Bonn took over as the capital after the war, obviously. But Berlin was a focal point, I think, because of the occupation. It was a place where the Germans, obviously, they had a city government and they had some influence on what was happening in the West. But it was really a place where people could come in and meet from other countries easily, and it became very important for espionage. Prior to World War II, obviously the British and French spent a lot of time in trying to find out, divine the secrets of the Germans. But after World War II, it was the Allies and Soviet Union working against each other, because that's where they could meet on the street, probably easier than any other country in the world. And it made Berlin a spy capital.
Mm. And obviously having so many different occupying powers in one place, it must have made it feel a bit like a pressure cooker. From an intelligence perspective, why do you feel that was sort of such an explosive arrangement?
Because of the way the different powers perceived the importance of that city. To the Allies, especially to the Americans, not so much to the French. I don't think they really gave it. And the British are less so. For us, we called it the outpost of Crete. It was a symbol of democracy in Europe, and it was forward-based, obviously, inside East Germany. The East Germans, the communists, and the Russians saw it as a thorn in their side. As long as the American, British, and French were there, that undermined their authority in the country, and it made it. So they wanted nothing more than to kick the Allies out, and that was one of the first crises in the city. So there was that antagonism between the four powers over the status of the city, but then it was expanded to all the other confrontations that were going on around the world. And Berlin, again, was the place where these things all came together.
Yeah, yeah. Can you talk to us a bit about sort of the kind of the history of the division of Berlin and kind of how, should we say, the Russians presented the east side of Berlin to the city residents? Because obviously they were kind of, they didn't have any, you know, they were kind of cut off from the rest of the world in some respects with this sort of division.
As you stated, Germany was divided after the war amongst the four victorious powers, France, England, or the UK and the United States, and then Russia on the east. Berlin, because it was the former capital, it was determined that would not become the capital for a while. And it was also split. But initially, the Russians did not want to give a part of Berlin to the French. So when the maps were made up, the British occupation sector was actually reduced in order to give France an opportunity to share in that occupation. I think you can attribute that to Charles de Gaulle. Charles de Gaulle was very insistent on occupying Germans. So the Allies, the three Allies, France, U.S., and Britain, presented Berlin as a center of democracy in Europe in the East, while the Russians and the East Germans countered that, and they presented it as a center for their progressive society, essentially. So all through a history of Berlin, you've got the West celebrating democracy and freedom, and on the other side, the Russians, not so much democracy, because there was none, but they were presenting Berlin as an example of what communism could do. All through the Russian occupation and through the existence of East Germany, they were touting the superiority of their methods over ours and vice versa.
Yeah. And why did they choose to sort of build the Berlin Wall to physically divide the city?
Oh, that's a somewhat longer story. 1945, the city was divided, occupied shortly thereafter. The city itself, from West Berlin, was isolated from East Germany, but not from East Berlin. So the city was essentially open. Yes, there was a marker, a line that showed the division between East Berlin and West Berlin. But as far as people, there was no restrictions. There were no restrictions. So once it became apparent that communism was not doing everything that it was supposed to in the East, a lot of people started to vote with their feet and left East Germany, left East Berlin, and came into West Berlin. They could not come into West Germany because there was another guarded frontier between East and West Germany. But they could come to West Berlin. And from West Berlin, they could travel wherever they wanted, by air or by train. So there was nothing that they could do. The problem was that East Germany was losing all its best people, and they were streaming into West Berlin, hundreds of thousands a year. And the East Germans saw that as a threat. Their economy was going to collapse, and it would have had they not stopped. So their only solution, once they figured out that the city was not going to be, the Allies were not going to leave, the only solution they could come up with was the anti-fascist protection barrier to keep those evil Westerners out of East Berlin. Well, in reality, it was to keep the East Berliners from escaping to freedom.
Yeah, wow. And from your time sort of serving there, did you ever get an opportunity to sort of get an idea of the East German perspective in the sort of 70s and 80s about the wall and East Germany and communism?
From the few opportunities I had to talk to East Berliners that would talk with me, I mean, if you talk to an official, obviously it was our way better than yours. But on the other side, it was I think more than anything, resignation that they had to endure this. They did not speak openly about going to the West, but they hoped that someday the wall would be taken down and they could reunify Germany and have a better one. There was not a lot of overt discussion of revolt or rebellion, because there was not talk of rebellion or revolt because the East German and the Russian security services were pervasive in their internal security. So they could not risk.
Yeah, because East Germany had an awful lot of sort of domestic spies spying on each other. I can't remember what the statistic was now, but it was an awful lot of people were spying on their neighbors. It was crazy.
Well, the ratio of official security officers, the East German Ministry for State Security, which is that guy right there, was about one officer for every nine Germans. So it was, I forget the exact numbers, something like 280,000 employees. And then they had networks of what they called unofficial Mitarbeiters, unofficial comrade workers, essentially. And there were hundreds of thousands of those. So you might have your children informing on you, or your next door neighbor, or your aunt or uncle, or whatever. And the people knew that. And so they just clammed up.
Wow. No, it must have been a very unpleasant experience for these Germans.
Well, I think so. They had a system called Zersetzung, which was essentially destroying the life of a person. If the East Germans or the Russians, especially the East Germans, if they found out somebody was talking bad about the regime or for any reason, they had a methodology to destroy the person's life, to make sure they would never go through. They would not go to college. Their children would not go to college. Their friends would not talk to them. They'd start rumors and innuendo, and even have them fired so that they would have to work menial labor. And it would destroy a person's life, and quite often it would destroy their sanity.
Moving back to kind of the intelligence side of things, so what role did the CIA's Berlin operation base play in Berlin compared to, you know, other CIA stations across Europe?
The main CIA office in a country, which is normally in the capital, is called a station. And any other bases or any other offices that are set up in the country, or sometimes in an adjacent country that doesn't have a capital or doesn't have a station, are called base. So because the CIA's station was in Bonn, Berlin had what was called the Berlin Operational Base. And from the very beginning, well, not quite, the OSS had the first office there. And then when the OSS went away and the CIA came along, it became the Berlin Base. Its mission was to run clandestine operations inside West Berlin and also to try to project into East Berlin. It was not that big of a station or office. But it had the primary responsibility for running things in, whereas Bonn took care of West Germany, and it stayed in operation from basically 1946 until the end. Now, the American embassy had moved to Berlin, so the Berlin state or the station is inside Berlin.
And with regards to sort of, should we say, Western spies, what were they primarily sort of looking for in their kind of espionage efforts in Berlin?
Well, the agency, the CIA, concentrated on strategic intelligence, what the intentions and actions of the Russians or the East Germans might be, and also any of the other Warsaw Pact people that might be in the city. Whereas the military intelligence people were concentrating more on the strategic side of things, where the units were stationed, where the people were moving to, the types of equipment, things like that. So the the CIA is working at a somewhat higher level with the military. Obviously, the military wants to know what the intentions or what the plans of the Russians and the Eastern are. But that's pretty much what they concentrated on. Also, there was a very large counterintelligence element in Berlin because of so many spies, the British, French, and the Americans, as well as the people on the other side. Had a lot of counterintelligence agents that spend their time trying to find out where and who the Russian spies or the East German spies in West Berlin were.
Yeah. And how closely did the CIA, MI6 work together in Berlin? And yeah, were there signs that maybe the cooperation started to fray at certain times? Because obviously there was quite a few spy scandals during the Cold War. So, you know, especially the British side.
And later the American side too, and the French. Cooperation between the British and the Americans was greater than the cooperation between either the British and the Americans with the French. The French were a little bit more distant. Probably a good thing for that. There was very good cooperation at the beginning. Obviously, SIS or MI6 felt that the cousins across the way, the Americans, were a bit of country bumpkins and had the kind of experience they had, which was true. But they also had some issues with the Cambridge Five. And once that broke, once Philby and all the other guys were marked as traitors, there was a lot of suspicion between, mostly on the American side, of the British. That would happen, that would change a bit later. The British would not trust the American because James Angleton, who was a counterintelligence, he was a genius, but he was also more paranoid than anybody else in the entire world. So that did a lot for not helping the relationship. But there were good operations too. The Berlin Tunnel, for example, was a very joint British-American operation. The Teufelsberg surveillance, the electronic surveillance site, was a joint operation. It was American civilian collectors, military collectors, along with British GCHQ type people, and so now it's all good. So everybody was trying to cooperate, but at the same time, they were very wary of each other.
Yeah, of course. Now, you just mentioned the Berlin Tunnel, which is obviously legendary. Even though it was compromised, why was it still considered a success?
For a long time, it was discovered fairly early on by the Russians. The British and the Americans jointly built a tunnel underneath the wall to tap into the East German telephone system. And part of that telephone system included the Russian military networks. So they were basically pulling in thousands of messages, telephone calls, some data lines, and they were sharing all that information. It later came out that the Russians found out about this because of George Blake. And were aware that the Americans and the British were tapping their telephones, but they didn't do anything about it because they wanted to protect George Blake. It took them a long time to figure out a methodology to accidentally discover the site. So when it was discovered, and the fact that they had known about it for a long time, was revealed. Everybody said, well, they were just feeding garbage information through those networks. That was entirely wrong. They did not disturb their own communications because they thought if they did, people would become, somebody might be aware that it had been compromised. So they let all their standard traffic go through, classified talks, non-classified, everything. So it was a mistaken thought to think that this was a failure. And that in reality, they gained all kinds of very important information until the connection was finally cut.
Let's take a break and be right back with more.
Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for with SpinQuest exclusives. Blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just $10. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers. And $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
And you mentioned, now I'm not sure on the pronunciation, is it Teufelsberg, the Sigint site?
Teufelsberg. Devil's Mountain.
That's it. And it's become kind of iconic. And why was it such a kind of crucial and sort of critical signals intelligence site? And how exposed was it to sort of Soviet and Stasi counterintelligence?
If you go to Berlin and see Teufelsberg, you will readily understand why it was so important. It was built on a pile of rubble after the war. A listening post, a collection site that sits about 400 feet above the city. And this is on the North German plain. So if any direction you look, it's flat ground. This site could intercept radio and telephone traffic communications from the border between West Berlin or West Germany and East Germany all the way to the Polish border with Russia. It was the premier collection site for the NSA and GCHQ throughout the Cold War. I mean, they could listen to everything. And that was a big threat, obviously, to the Russians. I mean, they could listen to aircraft traffic, tank commanders on their radios, everything. So, yes, it was a very successful operation, but obviously it was a target for the communists. And they could not get into the site. Well, we could, but they couldn't. So they tried to compromise it by recruiting people that work there. Mm-hmm. And they had some success in that, and they had some people that volunteered to give information to the Russians or the East Germans. I'm going to pull a wild guess here and say maybe seven people defected or turned over information to the Russians. But basically what they were doing is telling the Russians what we knew about them. And so they could change things, you know? And that obviously was very important to them, or change the crypto, change their code systems. And so, but it was, like I said, it was very successful throughout the duration of the war.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was looking at, some of the photos in your book. So you got some wonderful pictures in your book, and, I was looking at, obviously, the historic photos of the site, and then obviously now you describe it as serving as a playground for artists. You know, what's happened to the site now?
When the Allies left, the site was abandoned, and it's not an extremely large site, maybe 2 or 4 acres, but there are buildings on top, and there are some interesting geodesic domes on top. So in the 90s, it became a place for homeless people, free-thinking people, artists, rebels to basically congregate. It became a big living place on one hand, and then on the other hand, it was a place to have parties or paint or whatever. And the artist colonies basically took it over and
yeah.
started doing murals on the outside, inside. I mean, the murals are ever changing. You go up there now, and what you saw a week ago might be completely different. The city of Berlin, the government, was going to destroy the site, return that whole area to the park inside, which it's inside of. But then people protest. And it was eventually declared a protected site. And now you pay admission to get into it, so you can go walk around these ruined buildings and see all this avant-garde art up there. So it's supporting the artists community in Berlin now.
No, that's good. That's good. Fantastic. So I'm going to move us a little bit into the Eastern Services, the KGB and the Stasi. So how did the KGB view Berlin compared to other cities, such, you know, in the Warsaw Pact and even Moscow itself?
Well, as we were talking about before, the KGB in Moscow were primarily interested in counterintelligence to stop the activities of Americans or the British or whomever. Although they did try to recruit Americans there and penetrate the American embassy, which they did several times successfully, their focus in that city was more counterintelligence. In Berlin, it was more offensive because they had access to the Allied services. They could try to recruit people to work on Teufelsberg. And they had immunity there. They could be in West Berlin conducting an operation. And if they were arrested, the only thing the Allies could do is throw them back over the wall. Same thing for America, the Americans in East Berlin. If you were caught doing something, the only thing they could do is throw you back. So for them, it was a very good opportunity to spy on the French, British, and the Americans, and the other people, because every government, yes, they had embassies at Bonn, but they usually had some kind of a mission inside Berlin, because it was so important for the United Nations, the different organizations over there. So that's one of the big reasons why they used every opportunity to try to get into West Berlin. For the East Germans, it was a bit more difficult because they were not they were not under the Four Powers Agreement. If their agents got caught inside West Berlin doing something or in West Germany, they would be arrested and imprisoned. So they had to be a lot more careful working in Berlin than the Russians. That meant, to some degree, the Russians were a lot less sophisticated than the East Germans. The East Germans had to be very nuanced and very careful in their operations. And there were Marcus Wolf, the head of the East German foreign intelligence operations, was a 3D chess player and worked everything out from beginning to end and was a very capable opponent. So that was their focus over there. Our operations in East Berlin were hampered, though, because of the East German and the Russian counterintelligence system. Because that security was so pervasive, it was extremely difficult for our people to work in those areas. Would have been easier for the Russians and the East Germans.
And what was the focus for kind of Russian intelligence in the West? What kind of information were they trying to get?
Well, you're always trying to get the intentions of the opponent's government. But the Russians were very concentrated on military capabilities. They wanted to know what kind of equipment we had, who our people were, what our operational plans were. And not only in Berlin, but in West Germany, they tried to get that.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they use places like London, New York for the UN and Washington to go for the extremely high level stuff, but definitely they wanted to use Berlin to get every possible competition.
Yeah, yeah. And East Germany sort of became a bit of a haven for sort of terrorist groups who were looking to undermine, should we say, capitalism. Do you have much insight on sort of to what extent these terrorist groups were sort of directed by the KGB or even the Stasi, and to what extent they were tolerated?
Tolerated is an interesting word. At one point, the East Germans created a special division within the Stasi. Had different names, but I think the last one was Hauptabteilung 22. Its mission was quote-unquote counterterrorism. But what they were actually doing was hosting and training terrorist groups from around the world to employ them in Europe. Carlos the Jackal, a number of the German Red Army faction terrorists found safe haven in East Germany. The Libyan bombers that blew up the La Belle Disco came through East Berlin. So the East Germans not only tolerated it, they didn't really direct it, but they tolerated it and provided support. And their whole goal was to destabilize the Western governments. The assassination of a student, an unarmed student, was shot by a Berlin police, West Berlin police officer. Turned out later that West Berlin police officer was an officer of the East German Security Service, or an agent of the East German Security Service. So the conjecture was he or was he not directed by the East German Security Service to kill the student, a left-leaning student, to cause issues? It turned out later that he was not. The East Germans basically cut the guy free because he was out on his own. But those kind of operations were definitely important to the Stasi because they wanted to undermine the Allies in Germany, and they wanted to undermine the German government.
Yeah, yeah. And with regards to the Stasi, we sort of touched on this, but what made sort of East German's intelligence system sort of so effective and so feared?
There's been also some discussion about who actually controlled the government in East Germany. Was it the Stasi or was it the Politburo? And a lot of the members of the Politburo were former Stasi people. They were so effective because they were the sword and shield of the party. They were to protect the party, and the party had total control, and they knew that without Stasi, they would lose control. Mm. So they had the full backing of the East German government, and the East German government basically gave them carte blanche to do almost anything they want. They were able to arrest people, put them up for trial, and seal them away for a long time if they would so much as be a threat, if they were seen as a threat to the government. So with a government that backs you like that, then you don't have a whole lot of trouble.
And do you think Western intelligence services underestimated the Stasi?
Some people did, especially in the early days. We also underestimated the KGB. I mean, we tried to run all kinds of insurgency operations in Albania, in Poland, in Hungary, and they were all compromised, and we sacrificed a lot of people. Of course, guys like Philby helped, but a lot of CIA and SIS people said they're not sophisticated. They won't catch us. But in reality, the KGB and the MFS were very, very sophisticated. I mean, they've been at this. The KGB was started as a clandestine organization of a clandestine political organization. So they were used to keeping secrets. I mean, from 1916, 1915 on, they had a hell of a lot more experience at running underground operations than either the MI6 or the CIA. So they were very geeked. And the East Germans, of course, learned a lot from the KGB, but they also became even more sophisticated than the Soviets. I think that was because they had a lot more people that had better education than the Russians did. A lot more education, a lot more exposure to the West.
And probably understood Germans better as well than the Russians did.
Well, definitely that too. They were able to infiltrate a lot of sleeper agents into West Germany because of that. People, especially after the war, people that got caught up in East Germany or in Eastern Europe, some people that sought asylum in Moscow because of the Nazis, came back to East Germany. And then they were able to slip them into the West with forged documents or a very good cover story. And they joined the government and were able to infiltrate the West German government much easier than trying to go the other way.
Yeah, yeah. Can you talk to us a little bit about Marcus Wolf? Because he is considered, responsible for some of the most successful penetration operations during the Cold War. Why were they so effective against West Germany?
Marcus is one of those guys that went east when the Nazis came in. As a young man, he and his brother, his parents moved to Moscow. He learned Russian. He spoke Russian fluently. He also spoke English. At the end of the war, he was a journalist for the East German radio system, and he even took part in the Nuremberg trials as a journalist reporter. But he was actually working for the Stasi. He was just an extremely smart, again, a 3D chess player. Understood the Germans. He was a German, obviously. Well-read. And understood the motivations and needs of his target audience. He was especially good at doing the so-called honeypot-type recruitments. He also put a lot of sleeper agents into the West. He was just... He had no compunction about deceiving his own government and doing things that they had no idea of. I mean, he was a guy that would go out and do something and worry about asking forgiveness later. So he's got a very good biography.
Yes. I've just bought a copy. I've got it. I can see it on my shelf at the moment. Did you know he's also written he wrote a cookbook?
Yes.
And I just found a copy. It's all in German, so I'm going to have to brush up my German to understand the book. But apparently it's quite... I mean, I've seen some of the images in it, and there's some fun stuff in there, but it seemed quite an interesting book.
I had not seen a physical copy. I was tempted to buy one I saw on a website a while back. It was signed by Marcus Wolf and endorsed to Erich Mielke, who was the head of the Stasi, the actual director of the whole organization. But they wanted too much money for it.
Yeah, I'm surprised the Spy Museum haven't snapped that copy up. No, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. Marcus Wolf, a fascinating character, and some say he might have been the inspiration for John le Carré's Carla, who was Smiley's sort of opposite number.
although I think Jean le Carré continued to disavow that, maybe because he didn't want to give Marcus too much credit.
Yes, true. Or not, maybe get sued by Marcus post-Cold War, but... Let's take a break and be right back with more.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Bretsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretsky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
So many, many years ago, I was chatting with a journalist, Stephen Gray, who wrote a fantastic book called The New Spy Masters. And somewhere in my conversation with him, he mentioned that a CIA officer, and I believe it was Milt Bearden, but I could be wrong, said that Berlin was for amateurs, but Bonn was where the real action was sort of going on. I was wondering what you thought about such a statement about Bonn versus Berlin, especially in sort of espionage history, because I find it all fascinating.
I don't know. Maybe he thought it was too easy making up Berlin because when I was working with the agency, I used to hear all the time that you people out in Asia, you people out in Africa, you have it easy, but you don't have any hard targets like Russian, Chinese, which is totally wrong because in fact, at point of fact, more Russians and more Chinese have been recruited in places like Africa and Asia than in China or Moscow or Bonn. So because once you get them that far away from their home, that far from their normal place, they become either a lot more willing or a lot more vulnerable to approach. So Bonn was a lucrative place for espionage, probably had more high-level diplomats with all the embassies. That might be more of what he's thinking of. But I think as far as the element of danger, of compromise, losing information was probably a lot higher.
Yeah. And obviously, when the wall fell, what happened to sort of Berlin's intelligence ecosystem?
Best way to put that is it's consolidated and solidified inside the city. The German intelligence elements, which were some were in Bonn or near Bonn, and some were down by Munich, all coalesced and came up to Berlin. Obviously, all the embassies moved back to Berlin and brought their people with them. So now you're, instead of being spread out over the West Germany, they're all focalized inside East Berlin or inside Berlin. Obviously, the Stasi went away. I don't know of any Stasi people that were picked up by the West Germans, although I think some came back for debriefings voluntarily. Marcus Wolf was not one of them that voluntarily was debriefed. Berlin, I think, has a lot more official presence of intelligence officers now. And for that reason, it's still very important in the espionage community, especially with all the continued traffic between Western Europe and Eastern Europe. The countries like Poland and Czechia, now I guess that's the name, and Latvia, Lithuania, those countries, a lot of them rely on Germany for assistance and for military aid. And for that reason, Berlin remains a hotspot of espionage activity. It's become more difficult for the Russians, obviously, although their embassy is still very large there. So it it's an important player still.
Well, yeah, Germany is very much a target for Russian espionage, especially today, especially in light of the war with Ukraine. And there's all sorts of things sort of going on. There's influence operations. There's been sabotage operations. There's been an assassination attempts. So Berlin's very much still got a lot of, contemporary spying going on.
Yeah, I think Angela Merkel, who was born and raised in East Germany, was trying to accommodate, not appease, but accommodate the Russians. And I think Germany has turned away from that to some degree now that they see that Russia is a possible threat once again. So
yeah,
I think we're possibly going into, we'll see how it comes out with Ukraine. I think we may be starting World Cold War II before too long. I know a lot of people have postulated that. I don't think we're there yet. But
We definitely feel like we're getting there. Yeah.
Yeah. The world's a lot more multipolar now than it was. And before it was just us and them, and now it's us and everybody else.
Yeah, totally. I've got a couple more questions. This might be the harder of the two, but so if Berlin was to teach us one enduring lesson about intelligence and power, what do you think that lesson would be?
Well, that's kind of like real estate. Location, location, location. The city gave everybody the opportunity to play on basically a level playing field with virtue roles, and not only was it an opportunity to spy on people, it was an opportunity to be spied on. People always think about, what are our advantages? How do we win this thing? And kind of forget about those in-run opportunities that you need to defend against. So I think Berlin encapsulated everything about the intelligence business in one location.
Yeah,
it was hopefully we'll never see a situation like that again, but I think it was unique in the fact that you had so many powers so close together, ostensibly working together, but in reality working against each other, even on our side in some cases. So it was a unique opportunity, and I'm just thankful that I was able to take part in it.
Yeah, fantastic. Have you been back to Berlin much since your time you were stationed there and operating there?
Came back in the 90s a couple of times, and then I laid off. Once the wall fell and the city became one, it lost a lot of the flavor for me. Before, I had a... It was not only a new place to be, but I had more of a purpose. So going back now, or back then, it was quite different. I've been back, though, now a number of times in the past 2 years. I've been back there, I think, 4 times. So it's regained some of the interest for me, primarily for the historical aspects. But yeah, still very different than what it was.
Yeah, indeed. Now, I'm yet to do a proper trip to Berlin. I'm hoping to do it either this year or early next year. I'm trying to pick the right moment where it'll be atmospheric. And I'm thinking like autumn time is probably a good time to go. But do you have any favorite sort of spy sites or locations in Berlin? There's loads in your book, and you've got great photographs of all sorts of things from like the CIA headquarters there and so on. So are there any spy sites for you? Is there a top five that you would love, you love seeing when you go to Berlin?
Like I said, it's changed quite a bit, but there are still some great, Spandau Prison, where Rudolf Hess was turned into a parking lot, literally. Not much of the wall remains. I think one of the best places to go to see and feel what the wall was like is a place, what is called Bernauer Straße. The Berlin Wall Museum is there. There's a remnant of the wall and a tower still there. That's a good place to go visit. Down around the Brandenburg Gate is just interesting to get sort of the flavor. the wall is gone, but the area is just, it's a beautiful site. It's next to the Terror Garden, the very large green area. The French and American embassies are on either side of the Brandenburg Gate, where they were before they were bombed in World War II. The Russian and British embassies are close. And then you've got the Adlon Hotel, which is very famous in novels, especially of 1930s Berlin. And then walking further to the east, you can go all the way to the Friedrichstrasse Bahnhof, which was very important in spy movies and other places. So that area is also good. Also very close, but very touristy now, is Checkpoint Charlie. There's a McDonald's there, which if I had put there before the wall went down, probably would have led to the fall of the East even quicker. But there was a museum that's been there forever. It was there before the wall went down, called Checkpoint Charlie Museum. It's interesting, but it's also kind of tired. It's just stuffed with memorabilia from the wall and everything else. It's an interesting place. A highlight, if you're interested in espionage history, actually two. One is the Glinica Brücke, Bridge of Spies, which is a ways out. It's in the southwest of the city between Potsdam and Berlin. Go there during the night when it's all lit up. It's just really interesting. The other, there's a German spy museum, which is fairly small. It does not equate to the International Spy Museum in Washington, but it's worth a visit. But the other place I would really encourage you to go see is the Stasi Museum, Normannenstrasse. It does not deal very much with the foreign intelligence side, but it does deal a lot with the oppression, the Oberst basic security atmosphere. And it's inside the headquarters of the old Stasi. And it's a remarkable event. It's very important.
Are there any cool bars that have some spy history? Because I've been to the Vienna Inn in the US, which I like, and there's a few bars in London. But
there is a restaurant very close to the Friedrichstrasse Bahnhof or train station. There was a hangout for the Stasi and other places. It's close to the Biedendammer Brücke, which figured in several war movies, that I think a Jason Bourne movie. The Savoy Hotel is another one.
Savoy Hotel.
Yes, Savoy. We're in the process of refurbishing it, but right after the war, it was the headquarters for the British MI6.
Oh, cool. And there's one bar that you mentioned as a personal meeting site.
God, it is. It stands for Department Store of the West, Kaufhaus des Westens. It's the largest department store in Europe. And on the fifth and sixth floor, it's got a food hall and a couple of restaurants. It's got like 40 small little restaurants inside their food. And it's a food department, much like Harrods. All kinds of expensive but nice food. The restaurant I was trying to remember is called Ganymed, G-A-N-Y-M-E-D. It's right close to the Friedrichstrasse train station, and it's on Bertolt Brecht Strasse, which has a nice theater next door. It was a place where Stasi would hang out and try to get all the Westerners that were going to the theater and then would come out to the Strasse on F. So, but it's a very cool place just to sit next to the river and eat or inside of the bar. Great place.
Oh, cool. Were there any bars that you used to frequent when you were in Berlin?
Well, there were several that were close to where our unit was located, but most of those have thankfully closed down because <'cause laughs> we tended to go to a lot of dives. We, like I was saying, downtown on the first of Dom, there are a number of old places. So, Savoy and Odell, one of them has a whiskey bar in there. It was not to be passed on.
Oh, cool. Okay. Well, that's a very good recommendation there. Brilliant. Do you have any favorite works of fiction, either movies or books that are set in Berlin that you feel capture the atmosphere of the city?
A fun movie, Run Lola Run.
Oh, yeah. That's a great film. Yeah.
Spy Who Came In From the Gold is probably the most famous and probably a very good representation of some of the sadder aspects of in the intelligence work of sacrifice and compromise and being used by an intelligence organization. And you've got some of the Lynn Dayton books and movies also that are very good. Lynn Dayton. Love Berlin also.
Yeah. Funeral in Berlin, great film. And I haven't read the book, but I love the film. It's very good.
Yeah, the book, both Funeral in Berlin and Berlin Game are also very good. So, and of course, at some point, we're probably going to see a Slow Horses episode done in Berlin. His very first... Mick Aaron's very first, well, it's not very first, it serves as the prologue for the Slow Horses. And now I can't remember the name of it, but it's set in Berlin. It'll be very interesting.
Yeah. I think if I remember correctly, Jackson Lamb's character has a sort of connection to Berlin, doesn't he?
He's still intimating everything, but it began there in Berlin.
Well, James, thank you so much for your time today. Where can listeners find out more about you and your book and your other works as well?
Well, thank you, Grid, for having me on, despite the fact that I sound like a frog. I do have a website. If plug in my name, it will show up. I'm also pretty active on Facebook and a lot of stuff there.
Yeah.
So that's probably the best thing. You can see all my books on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. I have an author page on Amazon, too.
Well, thank you again, James. It's been really great to chat with you today and to finally meet you in person. Well, virtually in person, not actually in person, but yeah.
Yeah, I can't reach out and throttle you. anyway, or you me, but thank God. Anyway, thank you very much, Chris. It's been fun.
Great, thank you.
For listening. This is Secrets and Spies.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey, everybody. Lady Luck here. And we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey, everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers. And $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.